In a world of need, we need medical care. Without delay.
Delay.
Without bias. Without bureaucracy. Without prejudice. Without violence.
Civilians are not expendable.
Without apathy. Without division. That's why we need Doctors Without Borders. Save lives at msf.org.au.
This podcast is supported by Brisbane Economic Development Agency. When Ulta Steel CEO Paul Zuckerman chose Brisbane for Australia's first low-carbon steel mill, Brisbane Economic Development Agency, BEDA, was there from day one.
BEDA was an early relationship for us, and they've just been so supportive. I think they're great at connecting businesses and really just open doors for us.
Brisbane Economic Development Agency connect business, research and government with opportunity. Search Choose Brisbane for more information.
This is The Guardian.
If it works out, I'm going to take the credit. If it doesn't work out, I'm blaming JD. You better be careful, JD. He's going to turn his plane around and get the hell out of here. Yeah, I like that idea.
I'm Regid Ahmed.
And I'm Jonathan Yeroshelmi.
And this is Decoding America, a podcast from Guardian Australia. Jonathan, that was a jesting Donald Trump there. He's kind of joking about pinning the success or failure of the Iran deal on Vice President J.D. Vance. But is there a bit of a grain of truth in that strategy?
Yeah, the White House seems determined to make J.D. Vance the face of this deal, even as the Vice President is forced to defend outbursts from Trump that have threatened to derail the talks.
What we told the Iranians yesterday is when you guys engage in what us millennials might call trash talk, you can't expect the President of the United States not to respond and not to correct the record.
Jonathan, it's so good to be back after a short break.
It's lovely to be here with you again.
We're also going to cover whether Americans are falling out of love with the Kennedy dynasty. I know we've got one in cabinet at the moment, RFK, but there's another one.
Yes, there's another one up for election right now as we speak in New York.
As we speak. But first, we've been hearing those comments from Donald Trump and J.D. Vance on this MOU, this Iran, they won't call it a peace deal, but a memorandum of understanding that they're trying to basically get finalized. I was fascinated that Donald Trump, when he first started talking about this, described it as preventing a worldwide depression. Is this a desperate US president?
I mean, that's certainly what the commentary has been, isn't it? I mean, I think it's helpful to look at this memorandum of understanding because that will give us a better idea of just how desperate or otherwise Donald Trump is. I've been informed by some of my colleagues that everyone's not as interested in this deal as I might be, so I will try and keep it brief. But I think
we're interested.
The nitty-gritty is really interesting. So the Obama nuclear deal from 2015, we've talked about it many, many times. Donald Trump pulled out of it. It was years in the making. It was more than 150 pages long. It went into detail on inspection schedules of nuclear facilities. It looked at enrichment levels. It was a very, very detailed document. This MOU is a page. It is one page. It is 14 points. A page either side, to give Donald Trump credit. It is 14 points. And it has been really interesting looking at how America has been selling this. So, for instance, when it was announced last week, we knew that this MOU had been signed, but we didn't know what was in it. And the Iranians were saying things, the US were saying things, and it wasn't clear quite what it was going to be.
It was drip-fed out, as usual.
Deliberately. And the way that America, the White House, told journalists is they got them onto a call. There were some of our gardening colleagues on that call, and they read the MOU out to them. They didn't give them a kind of finished copy until they'd read it out to them, and that allowed them to add in their own commentary, their own spin on it, for instance. And you saw a lot of credulous reporters then reporting on this deal with the kind of White House spin on it. And I think the fact that they were unwilling to just release it out immediately gives you an idea of quite how concerned they were about it.
So both Iran and the US are basically trying to spin it. And we should say they can't call it a peace deal because that has to go to Congress, right?
Well, and also this is the start of a deal. Right. So this is the start of a 60-day negotiation period, which J.D. Vance is leading, which they hope will get them to a point where they can agree to a final agreement on the nuclear deal, this big issue that's mm-hmm. been overhanging everything. I mean, if you think about why Donald Trump said he went into this war, he talked about a lot of things. He talked about regime change in Iran. He talked about getting rid of their ballistic missile capability. He talked about getting rid of their connection to proxy forces in Lebanon and Yemen. But the big thing was the nuclear program. And what this MOU does is not address that at all.
So now that we've explained the 101 of it, so much of what Donald Trump does is about the performative, being seen as the face of the administration. So why then is J.D. Vance the one selling this deal and not Trump himself?
Well, there's a few reasons for that, and some of them are quite good reasons. The Iranians are known to favor J.D. Vance over other negotiators. He's seen as someone who is, we know, less willing to go to war. He doesn't want foreign conflicts. He's seen as someone that they can deal with, and they know that he's less close to Israel, the Israeli government, Benjamin Netanyahu. The negotiations...
We will come to that too.
Exactly, yeah. Very important part of it. The negotiations were previously being led by Steve Witkoff, who is Donald Trump's real estate buddy come special envoy, and Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. And I think a lot of the Iranian negotiators saw them as being too close to Israel and they didn't trust them. Obviously, there were negotiations happening in February. They ended quite abruptly when the US and Israel launched this war. But I think that J.D. Vance is seen as someone that they can do business with. He's been adopting quite a collegiate tone in these meetings so far, and I think that has been really important for them.
Except for what we heard at the top, where he was responding to, Donald Trump almost seemed to threaten to kidnap the Iranian negotiating team. He got really upset, and J.D. Vance was not willing to criticize Donald Trump.
No. Well, this was Sunday, Monday. The negotiations were ongoing in Switzerland. It was the first time that, the U.S. side was sitting down with the Iranian side for months, and Donald Trump was back in America tweeting away, appearing on Fox News, saying things like, if they fail to rein in Hezbollah, I'm going to attack them again. I might put tolls on the Strait of Hormuz. He said, you close the Strait of Hormuz again, you won't have a country. You won't even make it back to your fucking country. So the Iranians didn't take that very well. They walked out.
That was a quote, wasn't it?
That was a direct quote. That's not me just swearing randomly. That was a direct quote from Donald Trump. Thank you for making that clear. They walked out of the talks. And J.D. Vance had to go in and kind of smooth things over. And that was what that clip we heard before.
Yeah, trash talk. The irony here is that J.D. Vance, and we've spoken about this before, is reportedly one of the few people right at the start to have said, I don't think we should do this. I don't think we should go to war. And then here he is now kind of being the fall guy.
Yes, it's one of the strange ironies of working for Donald Trump, I'd imagine. We know from that New York Times reporting that we've talked about on this show many times that inside the Situation Room, when Donald Trump was quizzing his cabinet members on whether they should go to war, J.D. Vance was the biggest opponent of it. Eventually, he said something along the lines of, look, if you back it, I'll back you. And he has been backing him, and he has been a very, very loyal servant to Donald Trump. When the details of this deal was coming out last week, J.D. Vance was booked in to appear on TV shows, news programs, The View, podcasts, and he was booked in to talk about his new book on Catholicism, about his conversion to Catholicism. There wasn't much chat about Catholicism in the end. He was out there having to defend this deal, having to,
So he wasn't actually booked in just to talk about the deal.
He was there to talk about his book, yeah. And unfortunately,
and then it had to be rewired.
Well, I think the deal was coming out. And obviously, if you're a journalist and a deal is coming out, you're not going to just be asking him about his book. You're going to be asking about, the deal. And, we've seen all these clips of him going viral, talking up the deal, saying it's so much better than the Obama deal. And just no one from any side of politics really believing him.
We're going to come in one moment to how J.D. Vance has spoken about Israel. Israel is really key to this war finally ending. But I just wanted to make the point, Donald Trump does need this deal to happen. He does need this war to be over, because I was looking at the amount of oil they've got in their reserves now. It's the lowest level since 1983, which is when Reagan first filled up the reserve. Things are bad.
And not just that, the Department of War is going to Congress saying they need upwards of $80 billion to replenish stocks of missiles and things. This war has really exhausted America in many, many ways. And I think that it is indicative of why Donald Trump has made this agreement. He is giving up, you know, he's allowing Iran to export oil. He's waiving those sanctions. He's promising them, you know, the end of all sanctions. He's unfreezing assets already that they're going to be able to spend on things. And he hasn't got anything yet. Mm. All he's got is the Strait of Hormuz opening up. And he's already giving quite a lot of way that he, you know, he had pledged not to give away until they sorted out their nuclear program.
So much for art of the deal. Let's have a listen to J.D. Vance. He had some really strong words for Israel's government.
Donald J. Trump is the only head of state in the entire world who is sympathetic to the nation of Israel at this moment in time. And he happens to be the head of state of the world superpower. If I was in the cabinet of the Israeli government, I might not be attacking the only powerful ally that I have anywhere left in the entire world.
How extraordinary was that broadside?
It was pretty amazing. I wrote a story last week about the reaction to this deal in Israel, and almost universally, everyone in Israel hates it because it doesn't solve the problem of the nuclear issue, it doesn't solve the problem of the proxies, of the missiles, and it boxes Israel into a corner where if they are to follow this memorandum of understanding, they are not allowed to continue their assault in Lebanon on Hezbollah. Benjamin Netanyahu is said to be furious about this, and if you listen to his cabinet members, his acolytes, the people he sends out into the media to talk on his behalf, they are really angry. And J.D. Vance is one of the few people in the cabinet, and certainly in the Republican Party, who already had this view of Israel, that actually perhaps we shouldn't be sending them so much money, perhaps we shouldn't be supporting them out that much, perhaps looking at what happened in Gaza over the last few years, we should be starting to withdraw some of that help. He is emblematic of a view in the Republican Party, on the right of that party, that is, we just need to cut Israel loose. Tucker Carlson says things like this. You hear Megyn Kelly saying things like this. It is a wing of the Republican Party that is loud and growing all the time.
So then finally on this, what does that say about J.D. Vance's future plans, his brand, his desire to perhaps become the next U.S. president? What does it all mean for that?
Well, look, a lot of people are looking at these negotiations, looking at how Vance has to carry the can for them, looking at how awkward he's been in some of these interviews and saying Donald Trump may have scuppered his chances for 2028. Now, it's probably a bit too early to be saying that, but Vance represents the America First wing of the party. If Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, is the more traditional Republican, the more neoconservative, more hawkish, more willing to enter into foreign entanglements, Vance is certainly from the kind of, you know, let's just stay out of this. He's someone who served in Iraq, and he was said to be furious about what he thought was the waste of American lives there. So the fact that he is now representative of this deal, of this war, in a lot of people's minds, that's really, really going to hurt him.
If this could be so bad for J.D. Vance, why is he so willing to do it?
Yes, in the US media, some people have started to call him Boy Kamala. So like Kamala Harris was Biden's vice president.
I'm very uncomfortable. There's a lot.
Stay with me.
Gendered.
Stay with me.
There's a lot there.
She was Biden's vice president who, you know, wanted to be president and had to defend, you know, all of the questions over his mental facilities, you know, had to defend the economy, was given a bunch of poison pill assignments by Biden, like having to, you know, work at the border and sort out all the border issues. And it's thought that really, really hurt her when she came to run. And Vance is in a really similar situation. He's out there defending an old president with questions about his, you know, mental faculties, mm-hmm. with questions about the economy, and he's being sent to do all the dirtiest jobs like this Iran deal. And the, you know, the question of why he's doing it is really interesting because Trump is said to have been asking cabinet members, asking visitors to the White House, you know, who do you think it's going to be, J.D. Vance or Marco? He's quizzing people all the time about who he thinks should be running in 2028. And I think Vance is incredibly concerned that he's losing the support of the president. The president seems to be quite close to Marco Rubio. He's said to quite favor him. He's certainly not giving him the tricky assignments.
Boy, that's a long way from little Marco Rubio.
Yeah, I mean, it's that friendship, we could do a whole podcast
yeah,
on that.
Yeah, but maybe we will.
I think that Vance is desperate to be the anointed successor to Trump. He wants to be given the MAGA crown in a couple of years' time and for Trump to say, yes, this is the guy to vote for.
And he might do whatever it takes, potentially, allegedly.
I think he's already doing whatever it takes.
Jonathan, look, speaking of possible presidential elections, we have some more lower level US elections happening, some Democratic primaries, and one high profile name that has been fighting this primary for a New York House seat is a Kennedy.
Yes, Jack Schlossberg. We're looking at New York 12. This is the richest district in New York. And if you think about New York and how you imagine Manhattan, it takes in all the parts we recognize. It's kind of the Empire State Building, Central Park, the Upper West Side. This is a really important house seat.
I saw it described in The Guardian as it encompasses the Seinfeld territory of the Upper West Side, the old money grandeur of the Upper East Side, and the uber expensive apartments south of Central Park, which make up the building. Billionaires Row. That's a quote, I should say. I don't want to claim that beautifully woven together sentence. But that just tells you this is not quite the MAGA base, right? These are very wealthy people.
Well, and it's also a very Democrat seat. So whoever wins this primary is going to be the House member for this seat. It was left vacant by Jerry Nadler, who is resigning. He's, you know, a veteran of the U.S. House, veteran Democrat. But now there's this really, you know, very, very vicious fight for who's going to get it.
So one of the people that was running, and we are getting some results, we'll have you take us through it, is a man, Jack Schlossberg, as you've said. He looks like JFK Jr. He really looks like a Kennedy. Let's just have a listen to him. He was did an interview with the New Yorker's Radio Hour about whether he's qualified for the job.
I've been representing a family legacy that is synonymous with the Democratic Party and progressive values. And in 2024...
What does that mean? Beyond the sheer presence of
that means,
in the
you
world.
Know, working for and with the John F. Kennedy Library, presenting the Profile and Courage Award.
You presented the award.
Yeah, and represent, you know, my family in alongside my mother as ambassador to Japan. It's a, you know, it might not sound like work to some people, and I'm not saying that that's a traditional job, but a lot of work that goes into it.
What do you reckon? Is there a future Kennedy politician in our sights?
Well, what you may not have got from that clip was how thin-skinned he appears when he's questioned about his experience. So Jack Schlossberg is 33 years old. He's the grandson of JFK, the president who was assassinated in 1963.
And the son of Carolyn Kennedy, who was former Australian ambassador.
Yes, she was ambassador to Australia under Biden. Jack Schlossberg spent quite a lot of time in Australia traveling around. I think when he was here, there was a lot of articles written by the Australian tabloids about who is this young Kennedy? Could he be president one day? And this is his first chance of kind of running for a House seat. And I've just been looking at the results. He got 10% of the vote. Not great.
Not good.
And he was leading in this race just a few months ago.
So what's the big criticism then? Why are people saying this might tell us something about what America might want?
Well, I think the part of the problem is that there was this New York Times story that was published a few months ago that revealed what was happening behind the scenes of his campaign, and it didn't look good. So he needs to prove that he's a serious player. There's obviously accusations of nepotism. He is a Kennedy with very little experience, and he's running for one of the most prestigious House seats. And yet, during this campaign, the New York Times reports that he is blowing off campaign meetings, he's going for naps, he's not going to strategy meetings, and he's churning through staff. Now, his aides have defended him and said, look, this is just part of campaigning. Also, his sister died at the end of last year, and I think that hit him really hard. And that,
yes,
you know, obviously,
that's been
be
given
difficult.
As a potential reason.
Yeah, and that's going to be difficult. But I think if you look at some of his experience, he's got Nancy Pelosi campaigning for him, the former Democratic House Speaker endorsing a 33-year-old. What other 33-year-olds who have never run for office is she endorsing? Ron Klain, a former White House Chief of Staff, is advising him. What other unknowns are being advised by former White House Chiefs of Staff? You know, he's got an MBA from Harvard, very, very impressive, but he's done very little else. So he says he was a correspondent for Vogue magazine. He wrote 6 quite short articles in that time. You know, he's mainly a social media influencer. He spent a lot of time campaigning for Biden. He was unpaid. He became quite big on Instagram doing that. He mixes kind of criticism of his cousin RFK Jr., the current health secretary, with kind of slightly wacky videos where he dresses up and pretends to be Vladimir Putin, really odd stuff. But he's got an audience, but he's certainly never had what you and I might recognize as a normal job.
As a normal job. What does it say about America's love affair with the Kennedy dynasty? Because you could argue, well, hang on, is it a bit unfair to be criticizing him when you look at Donald Trump, big social media player, not any really political experience. And maybe Donald Trump is kind of the Republican version back at the beginning.
Well, look, I think if you asked any of us, you know, a decade or more ago, whether we thought the host of The Apprentice would be president one day, we probably would have said no. But I think it points to what certainly voters in that part of New York and maybe Democrats want, is they want someone with a bit of experience. They want someone with a bit of heft. And he wasn't really showing it. I mean, the Kennedy name is incredible in America. If, you know, they are America's royal family. As someone once wrote that if America had a Shakespeare, he would be writing the Kennedy story. It is this incredible story where JFK, his brother Robert Kennedy, both incredible leaders in that party, both assassinated well before their time. There have been multiple Kennedys in Congress, in other parts of state government, in diplomacy, you know, Caroline Kennedy as an ambassador. And there's also been a huge amount of tragedy as well in that family. And it is, there's still so much fascination that I think perhaps many thought he could get by on association with that name enough. And it's interesting that he can't.
And I suppose very briefly, that could lead us to what maybe this particular primary indicates, because some people are saying it's a test of Zohran Mamdani, New York mayor's approach to politics, socialism, progressive populism.
Yeah, and a lot of the candidates Mamdani endorsed have done really well in the primary today. You know, Jack Schlossberg has been, you know, endorsed Mamdani himself. I think he's not against him, but I think that's right, that Mamdani is maybe a better case of what the Democrats can do. Jack Schlossberg was talking about how he's fighting dark money, how he's not accepting super PAC donations. Well, Mamdani did the same thing. He just did it a lot more effectively.
All right. Well, I guess we'll have to keep talking about dynasties, whether they be Trump's or Vance's or Kennedy's. But let's go to a break. When we come back, Trump's reflecting pool refurbishment nightmare. And who's being blamed for it all going wrong?
In a world of need, we need medical care. Without delay.
Delay.
Without bias. Without bureaucracy. Without prejudice. Without violence.
Civilians are not expendable.
Without apathy. Without division. That's why we need Doctors Without Borders. Save lives at msf.org.au.
Full Story is supported by EY Parthenon. EY Parthenon is the global strategy consulting practice of EY, working with CEOs, boards, investors, and governments on their most critical decisions. They bring deep sector expertise, an investor mindset, and advanced technology to bring clarity to complex challenges. EY Parthenon helps leaders make better decisions in moments of change, anticipating what's next, finding opportunity in uncertainty, and translating complex shifts into real-world outcomes, turning insight into action. For more insights, go to ey.com/au/Parthenon. EY Parthenon, transformative strategy and transactions. Solutions that work in practice, not just on paper.